You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. 50 years ago this week, C.P. Snow delivered a lecture that incited controversy among intellectual circles. Snow was both a scientist and a novelist, so he straddled two worlds. He described a polarization of scientists and literary types, a situation where one group neither talked or communicated with the other. It's what he called the two cultures. And here's a bit of the lecture that describes what he was talking about. Let me read it to you from the lecture itself. Literary intellectuals at one pole, at the other scientists, and as the most representative, the physical scientists. Between the two, a gulf of mutual incomprehension, sometimes, particularly among the young, hostility and dislike, but most of all, lack of understanding. They have a curious, distorted image of each other. Their attitudes are so different that even on the level of emotion, they can't find much common ground. Non-scientists tend to think of scientists as brash and boastful. They hear Mr. T.S. Eliot, who just for illustrations we can take as an archetypal figure, saying that his attempts to revive verse drama that we can hope for very little, but that he would feel content if he and his coworkers could prepare the ground for a new kind of kid or a new green. And it goes on and on and on to talk about this gulf. And that is, as I say, it's 50 years ago this week. That was his lecture there. And how much of that has changed? What kind of gulf do we still have with intellectuals and scientists? And here to discuss that speech and the impact is Charles Seif. He's professor at New York University's Journalism Institute over there at NYU. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much for having me.
What is the history? Why did he decide to write this? And there must be a context this all happened in.
Yeah, this is a subject that goes back to dawn of time, to even before science existed. Back in Socratic times, there was a Socratic dialogue where Socrates talks about the astronomer Thales as being so absorbed in finding out natural sciences, looking at the stars, that he can't see what's before him at his very feet. He falls into a pit, and everyone laughs at him. So there's always been kind of philosophers laughing at these scientists who are caught up in getting their hands dirty dirt. But about the time that Snow was lecturing, this was 1959, the Cold War was very, very hot. The hydrogen bombs had just been exploded, and they were spewing fallout into the atmosphere.
Right.
Eisenhower was going to warn about the military-industrial complex and the scientific-industrial complex. And so there was this growing fear about what science was doing to society. And at the same time, you had literary intellectuals who abstracted themselves. They said that these scientists were mere tools, mere makers of gadgets, and they had no real depth to them. They saw the destruction that was being caused by science, and they felt that true beauty, true truth, had to be found through literature and through poetry.
T.S. Eliot,
through philosophy.
Right, right. And so in steps C.P. Snow, who has straddled both sides. Right, he's a novelist, he's a scientist, and what motivates him to take up this cause and trying to bridge the two, or at least explain the two?
Well, he felt he was very comfortable with both worlds, but in fact, he was not a very good novelist, and he was not a very good scientist. His scientific background: he was working in the Cavendish Lab in the 1930s, and he tried to synthesize vitamin A, and he failed. He actually had to retract the paper, and so he gave up science. He wound up working for the British government and doing a very good job at organizing science, but he himself, his scientific career was not very good. He was a popular novelist, but his novels really don't seem to have lived on. I've never read a C.P. Snow novel. I don't think very many of the audience have.
No. Yeah.
But he felt that he had seen this literary intellectual scorn of science, and he felt he wanted to address it because he felt that science was the way of the future, that he had this technophilic idea that science could bring peace and prosperity to Africa and to poor portions of the world.
It would solve hunger, world hunger, things like that.
That's right. And so he felt that what was in the way was the fact that the British intellectuals were standing away from the scientists, and they did not want to engage. And as a result, no one could bring science to the populace, to the public, and make it work for a utopian Earth.
Mm-hmm. And he felt that if you really were a well-rounded, well-educated person, you should not only just be able to quote Shakespeare, but you should be able to quote some of the laws of thermodynamics, right? If you really were well-educated.
Absolutely, absolutely. He noted, and I think that this is absolutely true, that someone who says, I've never read Shakespeare, is considered ignorant. But someone who doesn't know the second law of thermodynamics is not, even though this is fundamental to science. Even today, you get people, I guess there was a host of The View who not so long ago expressed ignorance about whether the Earth was flat or not.
Wow.
And it was only slightly embarrassing.
Well, 1-800-989-8255 is our number, 1-800-989-8255, talking about C.P. Snow's Two Cultures lecture with Charles Seif. And there was a very famous film done called The Private Universe. You may be familiar with this. It was a movie. It was a documentary, sort of a teaching tool, made around 1990, I'm going to say, in which some physicists, I think, took a camera, set up their video camera at the graduating class at Harvard, and just asked all 35 or so members and anybody else they could pull in if they knew why it was hotter in the summer than it was in the wintertime. And only two or three out of the whole population could understood that it's not because the Earth is closer to the sun.
It's true. We're strikingly ignorant as a society about some very basic facts. The archetypal question that a parent can't answer is, why is the sky blue?
Right.
It isn't that hard. And to accept the fact that, this is something that is imponderable, that I can't answer, that's beyond me, really, really appalled Snow, and it appalls scientists today.
Mm-hmm. Is the gap still here, do you think? Is it as wide? Is it narrow? Or a different kind of gap?
I think it's still there. I think that scientists have a very difficult time popularizing, in part because they do inhabit a separate culture in the anthropological sense. They speak a different language. Mm-hmm. They assume different things. They speak amongst themselves and don't quite understand non-scientists in the same way, and vice versa. And I think that occasionally when you have a scientist straying outside of the culture and trying to popularize, he is scorned. Carl Sagan in the 90s was denied entrance to the National Academy of Sciences. And it was a heated floor debate. And apparently one of the reasons given that he was a great popularizer, he was a lightweight, but he was spending all the time working on getting the public to understand nothing on science, which was not true.
1-800-989-8255. Kate in Binghamton, New York. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Fabulous. I definitely understand what you mean between this rift between the scientific and the literary. I go to university right now, and my boyfriend is a Latin major. So we see this rift between our own studies at all times. But my question is, how are we going to bridge this gap? How are we going to bring science to the community? I know vessels like this show are great for that, but how else are we going to bridge the gap between science and the literary aspects?
Charles, you got any suggestions?
Well, I think this is a start. This is a great show. But, you know, there's always been popularizers. Michael Faraday in the 1850s was giving a set of public lectures to English common people trying to explain cutting-edge physics. And it was very popular. But the rift remained. And you have wonderful books throughout the ages, both fiction and nonfiction, that attempt to get science and scientists to the public. And it inspires some. And yet the rift remains. I know a number of biologists who are inspired by Aerosmith.
Well, you can, and maybe, Kate, this is true at Binghamton, but you can go through the best four-year college in this private universe that was at Harvard. And people are proud that they spent 4 years in college and never took one science course. And they considered themselves to be educated people.
Yeah. I'm trying to force my boyfriend to take intro cell and molecular biology next semester since I minored in Latin.
Why? That's the deal. Why not just a science for non-science majors course? Something like that, as a requirement to get a bachelor's degree.
We do have a science course. We actually, you must take a lab of some kind here, yeah. Whether it be rocks for jocks or astronomy. You have to take some kind of science here at Binghamton, which is great because it does expose people to some of these fundamental ideas only if you're just skimming the surface.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling, Kate. Good luck. Good luck getting your boyfriend to take that course.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. 1-800-999-8255. We do have, I guess, now more popular media. You have Neil Tyson on The Daily Show, things like that. Johnny Carson for years brought astronomers on there. That's where Carl Sagan got his first start with the public.
Yeah, and Carl Sagan's Cosmos inspired, I mean, if you speak to today's generation of astronomers, a whole bunch of them have been inspired by it. So it does have an effect. But this cultural rift between science and, I'd say, even non-science, more than humanities, science is a different way of looking at the world, and it's hard to acquire, and it's foreign in many ways. So I think there's always going to be some difference between scientists and non-scientists. Mm.
And I think we have another rift that was not as evident then, and I think it's a rift between science and religion. You know, that's become a much bigger gap, I think, than the science and intellectualism.
Oh, absolutely. And it doesn't need to be that way.
Right.
In fact, speaking of astronomy, the Vatican's ex-astronomer, George Coyne, is very, very pro-evolution. He's trying to explain to the public why you can accept evolution and still believe in Christ, in his case.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that science seems to be clashing with the religion. It's getting worse since the Scopes monkey trial in the 1920s.
Yeah.
That is fairly, especially in American society, it's gotten worse over the years, I think.
Certainly has. David in Ann Arbor. Hi, David.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that the situation your guest describes isn't just true in science. I teach history, and study after study shows that Americans are incredibly ignorant of their history and of the history of other peoples and cultures. And your guest talking about Carl Sagan rang a bell with me. Stephen Ambrose, a historian with PhD after his name, was ripped by academic historians because he was a popularizer. He wasn't a real historian. So I think that the trend goes beyond science.
Okay, good point. Any comment about that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Any field of deep knowledge, they kind of try to isolate themselves with their own language and their own ideas. And after a certain point, it becomes almost anathema to try to break down those language barriers.
And now that that science is so specialized, the language is even more specialized. You can't tell somebody else what you do.
Yeah. biologists don't understand what physicists are writing about. Physicists don't want to understand what biologists are writing about. It's crazy sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we go to the phones. Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday on NPR News. I'm Ira Flater with Charles Seif of NYU. Let's see how many calls we can get in before we have to go. Let's go to Dana in Orleans, Mass. Hi, Dana.
Orleans, Mass. Yes, hello. As a prelude to my remark, I hated science in college. Now I love it. I was a music major, but now I really love it.
What turned you around?
Reading Fritjof Capra's The Tao of Physics.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're dating yourself now.
Well, it's all right. That's fine with me. I mean, I don't take too much stock in that book, but it really opened my eyes to physics and what it defines. Yeah. But and in ecology, too, once I got, in the environmental movement. But I want to say that I think popular songs contribute a lot to American scientific illiteracy.
Popular songs? In what way? Why?
Well, look at that. Let me give you an example. The Beach Boys have a beautiful song called Warmth of the Sun, right? But one line in it is, like my love for you, like the warmth of the sun, my love for you will last forever. Sun's not going to last forever. Sun's going to burn out in 5 billion years.
And well, you're not. You haven't got one. You haven't got one romantic bone in your body.
Or catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Come on. If a star ever fell, there'd be nothing left of the earth. Come on.
Okay, we get your point. All right.
Okay.
Thanks for calling, Dan. But a little bit extreme. No literary license there at all. But maybe he has some sort of point that there aren't enough songs in popular culture, except they pave paradise and put up a parking lot, you know?
I think there's a – they might be giant songs saying that the sun is a ball of incandescent gas, which is pretty good.
Yeah, well, there are We do see, though, that science in popular culture does have a tendency to change things. I'm thinking about Three Mile Island and then the film, China Syndrome, things like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That were influential.
And Keanu Reeves is a quantum physicist solving our world's energy crises with cold fusion. Popular culture is very important in the way people perceive science. And, of course, the mad scientist is the classic trope that from Frankenstein on that movies love.
And there's Al Gore, not to link him with the mad scientist, but that his movie was seen by millions of people.
And I don't know whether it's just a coincidence, but I think that helped turn the tide of belief in global warming.
Do you have any suggestions besides this show? I mean, in colleges, how colleges and universities might help out to cross this boundary?
It's always a tough one. I think not only forcing students to take...
Will that do anything to force them? You know, are they going to come away saying, well, I just have to take this course and not appreciate it?
Well, at least myself... For me, it seems that when you're forced to take courses that you don't necessarily want to take, but it's assumed that to do that, you have to be a literate person, you have to take that. Mm-hmm. It opens your mind to it. And I was forced to take some classics courses, and it opened my mind to what was going on in history and Greek democracy. So I think at least a little exposure can do a great deal of good.
I think that's a good way to end. I think that there should be some sort of science course that everybody has, whether they call it Rocks for Jocks, which I kind of like that one, or astronomy. But some introductory, so you see why at least scientists love what they're doing.
Just as you're forced to read Shakespeare in the Bible.
Yeah. There you go. Okay, good way to end, Charles. Thank you very much. Charles Seif is an author and professor at NYU's Journalism Institute. That's about all the time we have for today. We'd like to thank Greg Smith. He composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Key Maleski. If you have comments or questions and you'd like to write to us, the old pen and pencil way, typewriters work if you still have one, Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com or our new and improved Facebook. We'd like to get all of you to enjoy and join our Facebook crowd up there. And we could be tweeting all week on our Twitter site. And also in Second Life, we have a group of folks who are all dressed up in fancy costumes and wearing our T-shirts. So there's a lot of ways to join us in our social communities. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.